So good morning, and this is the first talk of Sunday morning, and thank you for hanging in. You're still here. Yesterday we talked about mindfulness as it is practiced in the platform of the body, within the environment of the body. And we talked about compassion and what it means in terms of having compassion and what compassion actually means as a concept and as a practice. It's a little bit more difficult to kind of pin it down in terms of compassion with respect to the body, because we tend not to have those kinds of perspectives. You know, we see the body as being something mechanistic. It keeps going until it doesn't. It has to perform in a certain way until it doesn't. We have our expectations. We have our motivations. We do things that seem to take care of the body. But in fact, sometimes those things might flip a little bit and become demands we make of the body. Because it makes sense, because, you know, without this body, we're very attached to it, by the way. I mean, I don't know if you've noticed, you can't go anywhere without it, right? So we're attached to it, not just physically, but emotionally as well. You know, you think of all the media images that we absorb, the concepts that we have of what we should look like, how we should dress, how we should present externally, how we worry about the internal pieces of the body that work and don't work, right? So it's really difficult to, I think it's a challenge for us to bring the concept of compassion towards the body. The idea of getting enough sleep. I don't know about you, but I really thought by now with two full nights sleep and nothing much to do for 2 days, I'd be rested. And in fact, I'm actually more tired. And my body is probably saying, well, thank goodness she's finally listening. This is how tired you are. So the challenge is turning towards that and caring for it. Not because, and this is the crucial thing that is important about compassion, is that we turn towards things and towards others not only because we see that they're suffering, but also because we have a wish for it to be alleviated. It's easier done for other people than it is for ourselves. You know, I turn towards myself and I see that I'm suffering. And then I try to generate this motivation to want the suffering to be gone. But then I get distracted. You know, dinner's got to get made, reports have to be written, people have to be seen, friends have to be called, the garden has to be weeded, you name it, there's something that needs to be done. So the concept of, well, I'll alleviate my own suffering, what do I have to do to alleviate my suffering, kind of gets short shrift. Kind of goes into, well, I'll go for a walk and I'll feel better. Well, that's great, that's terrific, but it doesn't deal with the source of my suffering. So it's important when we talk about compassion that we understand it's twofold. There's the empathy piece. I can see that you're suffering, and I know what it means for you to suffer, because I suffer too. There's the other piece, which is the action piece. I wish, or the motivation piece, which I wish for that suffering for you to end, just as I wish for my own suffering to end. Without the two, we're not really practicing compassion as much as we may be practicing a distant kind of relationship with someone else's suffering. It might even be pity. You know, I'm so sorry you're going through this. It's really too bad, isn't it? You know, that sort of thing. Oh yeah, I get the issue of homelessness in the city, you know, but, and really the city's got to do something about it, right? So we have to be careful that our compassion is really wholesome in that it includes a wish for the person or the people or ourselves to no longer suffer. We're still not at the engaged action yet, but we're at the motivational level. So we're motivated to want to do something about it. We are motivated to do something about homelessness. We may get on committees, we may get into programs, we may offer our assistance in any way that we can. We may make donations, you know, that's okay too. So it's important that we look at what it is that motivates us to want to put an end to suffering. You know, sometimes I hear people say, oh yeah, and I went to India and I went to Burma and there's so much poverty, and so I went to Africa, so much poverty, it's awful, it's terrible. But you know, I think that's just my Western view because I'm so privileged. The people there seem so happy. I thought, whoa, okay, I have yet to process that, right? In my mind, you know, there's a motivation, there's a connection with suffering. It's awful, it's terrible, we wouldn't wish this on anybody. And then there's the distancing, but they look so happy. So we have to be careful that our motivation accompanies very quickly behind that experience of someone else's suffering, including our own. Okay, including our own. I'm sneaking up on our own suffering. I don't want to expose you yet to it, so we'll sneak up on it. So today's talk is primarily about these icky things, these wonderful things, these precious things we have called emotions. Because they motivate us. Compassion is a motive, right? It's a motive to relieve the world of suffering. Emotions guide that compassion. So I want the world to be happy. I want everybody in this world to be happy, to be free from starvation, from political oppression, from, you know, loss, from grief, from all of it. That is my wish, sincerely and truly. The emotion that motivates that is sadness. It's the sadness that I feel when I think about the world and the state that it's in. It's the sadness that I feel when I meet with my friends and I know the things that they're struggling with. We have the privilege of also drowning it in really good desserts and dinners and stuff when we get together, but there's no getting around that we come together as people who love each other because we know that we each carry a weight of suffering and sadness in our lives. And because we love each other, there's another emotion, we're able to sit and cry and laugh and hold each other through all the conversations. I don't know how I'd survive without that. So while the sadness is there, there's also a tremendous power of love that I feel for my family and my friends who are always there to hold and to carry me through the difficult times in my life. The other emotion that motivates compassion is my own joy. I know what it feels like to feel tremendous joy about things. Not as much as I would like to. I'd like it to be permanent, but nothing is. But it's that joy that has me motivated to say, I would want that for you as well. So if we're trying to figure out what compassion has to do with emotions and wisdom, well, wisdom, as we talked about yesterday, is the insight that arises when we clarify our experience. Which means clarifying the experience of sadness. It means clarifying the experience of, you know, self-recrimination and shame and all of these icky feelings that we have. Anger, irritation, all of it. Anger is a wonderful source of doing good, but it can't be the only source. Anger can motivate us to make very powerful choices. But like all toxic sources of energy, eventually we become toxic if it's the only thing that we use. So anger has to be balanced by a level of acceptance that there are some things in the world that are going to take forever to change. I was in my early days as a bit of a rebel, a quiet rebel. I would get involved with, this was when the military was still ruling Burma and Aung San Suu Kyi was in house arrest, and the world was, you know, galvanized about, you know, around her figure and the political situation in Burma. And the Friends of Burma in Ottawa were very active, and they're a wonderful group. And they did a lot in terms of, you know, sponsoring refugees, making sure that people were aware of the political situation in Burma. So I would take part in the marches, and I would give some talks occasionally, but my talks were a little too peacenicky. They weren't well received because people wanted revolution. And I don't know much from revolution, so I couldn't speak to it. So I was speaking to one of the founders, and I think it was the founders. I mean, there were people who were very active, a couple were very active. And they were, I have to admit, the Burma card, the Burmese card, gets played quite often in terms of I find it's elicited from me quite often when I'm in those kinds of political groups, because they assume, well, you're Burmese, so you must be on our side. And I don't know how to tell them that I'm highly colonized as well, so it doesn't quite work out for me that way. But anyway, we were talking, and they said, well, you know, you, as someone who's Burmese, you must want to see the end of this. I go, yes, I do. I mean, I really do, absolutely. The military rule, having been a victim of it, it was horrific, horrific years, 63 years that they exerted pressure over, they exerted power. And so they said, well, we have to make sure that this happens in the next year, in the next 2 years. We can't wait any longer. And I think that's where I kind of pulled back and I said, you know, it'll take the time that it takes. It'll take the time when people in the world are no longer willing to tolerate what's going on. But from halfway around the world, there's very little we can do except raise consciousness. Well, that had to be the most unpopular thing I had ever said, apparently. And I saw it in their faces, the way they looked so betrayed that I was not going to advocate for revolution in my mother country. And my perspective, and has always been, perhaps because I grew up there, was very much that things will unfold as they unfold. We can do something about the direction in which it unfolds. We can do something about the support it has to unfold. But we can't make it unfold faster than the positive pressure we put behind it. And at that point in society, 10, 15 years ago, there wasn't that pressure to bring an end to the military government. It still is there, by the way. It hasn't gone away. But it shifted. You know, it shifted significantly. And while that's a very unpopular political perspective, as an emotional perspective within our own lives, we have to learn patience about how emotions arise, have a life within ourselves, and how they dissolve. Because we can't make them go away faster than the actual physiology takes care of it. But what do we do when we feel uncomfortable, when we have an uncomfortable emotion? We don't like the sensations, right? I don't like... Emotions are just clusters of sensations that we've learned how to name over time. Okay. So when these sensations come up, and I name it, I label it depression, I label it anger, I label it frustration, I label it joy, right? The icky stuff comes up and it's uncomfortable. I don't like it. I don't want it. I want it to be gone. So what do? Right. I go for a run. I go dig weeds in the garden. I call a friend. Yeah. I take out my bag of cookies. We have our strategies with which to avoid and to shift the sensations that we feel inside. It rarely occurs to us to observe these sensations, and I'm not saying sit with, I'm very active. Observe these sensations and notice how they appear. They give birth, right? They're born. They have a little life. Sometimes it's a bit of a destructive life because it doesn't feel good. You know, it's kind of like having the bug, right? And then eventually they dissipate because the physiology can't maintain that level of internal sensational feel for very long. It's biologically not possible. However, we think it lasts for days and days because guess what happens? I feel down. I don't like the sensations of, you know, the impending feeling like I'm getting depressed or anxious. I don't like it. It rises. It gets to a little level. I go, oh, I really don't like this. Why is this happening? I don't understand. What did I do? I was feeling really good yesterday. Look what I've done. I've escalated it. So it's no longer the original sensations. It's now a secondary level of sensations. And I can keep that cycle going for a few days, sometimes a few weeks, sometimes even months. So fibromyalgia is a little bit like that. It taught me a lot about how I can mentally escalate my experience. Right? You know, I feel a little bit of a muscle ache and go, oh no, here we go again, right? Just when I've got 25 million things to do and I can't afford to be fatigued and I can't afford the cognitive fog and I can't afford all of this, how am I going to get these things done? I can keep that going for a full 24, 48 hours, or entire week if you wanted to, thinking it's still the original muscle ache, but by the time I'm done, I'm more mentally agitated than I am actually physically in pain. So it's fascinating to watch this happen in my head. It's like a three-ring circus in there, and someone's always up on the trapeze swinging from one end to the other. With no safety net. And after a while, I found I just really just had to laugh at this and go, here you go again, bring in the clowns, right? Because it's so unnecessary and it's so silly. And it all hinges on my absolute stubborn refusal to stay with that initial arising of emotion and to be willing to be with it. To accompany it. You say, oh, here you are. I recognize you. We met last week. Sit down, have a cup of tea. How's it going? Oh, you think you're going to grow into depression? No, listen, let's just hang around for a while and see where it's going to go. And usually, most times, it doesn't go any further than that. Oh, panic attack, I recognize you. It's been about, what, 5, 6 years since we've met? Cool. What brings you into town today? Oh, right. We have to get the dogs to the kennel and we don't have a car. Yep, that would do it. Okay, well, why don't we call Frank and see where the hell the car is? Right. Okay. So it's that type of approach to it that diffuses it before it becomes something that's unmanageable. Now, that's not to say it isn't important, right? It's important to recognize, oh, this may be something I need to talk to my doctor about. You know, here's the anxiety seems to be showing up a little bit more often than it used to. This may be something I need to talk to somebody else about. Oh, the sadness is still showing up. And I'm staying with it, but it keeps showing up. Oh, okay, I need to address this. I need to address this at a much broader level than just sitting with it. But the first step is to not be afraid of it. The first step is to treat it as an old friend who's come back to visit to remind us that we need to take care of something. There may be a relationship issue I need to take care of. There may be, you know, my overcommitment to so many things and I may need to have to start saying no or even pulling back from things I've already committed to. There may be a whole lot of things that need to be addressed. So when I see these emotions as messengers, as people who visit, then I'm less likely to be reactive and to try and either get rid of them or suppress them. I'm more likely to use them as wisdom moments. So it's important that we learn how to welcome the presence of it, not to go inviting them in because, you know, randomly, But when they do arrive, to recognize that these are important moments. These are moments where things might shift. Things may need to shift. But if I suppress them, and as I said yesterday, mindfulness and meditation is a wonderful way of bypassing what we feel. Great tool. Right? Not meant to be used that way, but we end up doing that. But we can bypass our feelings in so many other ways too. And we have to be on the alert for that, to be attentive to that. Now, sometimes a good distraction is a healthy thing, as long as there's a commitment to come back and revisit what it is that's going on. There's nothing wrong with going for a walk to clear your mind, but the commitment has to be to come back and address the situation, or the feeling, or what the feeling is pointing. So emotions are wonderful things. Paul Ekman has a wonderful, amazing website called the Atlas of Emotions. And it's a very dynamic, interactive thing, and I love using it. I'd really recommend playing with that so you have a better understanding of how emotions interact with each other. From a mindfulness perspective, the key points in our practice when emotions arise, particularly when we're sitting, the key points in our practice are to notice how impermanent they are. They arise, hang around for a while, and if we don't mess with them, they dissipate. You know, one moment I'm devastated because of X. The next moment I'm wondering what they're going to serve for dinner, right? One moment I'm really upset about what happened at X and so meeting. The next moment I'm trying to remember, was that sale on at the Bay or was it on at, you know, Shoppers Drug Mart? I can't remember. The mind is shameless. It will bounce from one thing to another unless we lock down and tighten. And often we lock down and tighten around emotions because we're afraid of them. For good reason, but we're afraid of them. So the trick in mindfulness in our meditation is to notice how these sensations arise and they hang around for a while, and if we don't mess with them, they dissipate. The sensations arise, they cluster together, we give it a label. Oh, this is anxiety. And then we watch it and it dissipates. And it's no different from the itch that we feel. You know, you feel the itch on your face and you really want to scratch it. And if you're doing real hardcore meditation, you don't move, you leave it alone. You leave it alone because you want to watch how that itch is there and then it's not there. And the whole secret to meditation is to catch that moment of gone. Oh, it's gone. Can I catch that moment of gone? Because that logs into the brain and it reminds us that that moment of gone is actually a pleasant moment. You know, itches are irritating, right? And they're distracting and we want this perfect meditation. So that moment of gone is actually a pleasant moment. Now, ironically, if you're having a wonderful, joyous, you know, blissful meditation, the moment of gone in that blissful meditation is what we call an unpleasant moment. So now we have the sense of feeling tones, as pleasant and unpleasant feeling tones to emotions. Sometimes anger can have a pleasant tone. You know, I stood up for myself, I spoke my mind, I got the change I wanted. It can have a pleasant tone. Anger can have an unpleasant tone. So there are no bad emotions and good emotions. It's the feeling tone, depending on context, that gives us an attraction, a sense of what it wants. So remember yesterday we talked about our reaction to things. There's the pushing away, the clinging, and the confusion. When we add the feeling tones to that, we can have a pushing away that's a pleasant feeling tone. An attraction, that's a pleasant feeling tone. We can have a pushing away, that's an unpleasant feeling tone. An attraction, that's an unpleasant feeling tone. So that's what we pay attention to in our meditations, is what experiences am I pushing away? What am I clinging to? What's the feeling tone of where I am in this moment? And in the background, of course, the labeling is going on about, you know, what the emotion is and all of that. That's fine. But in the heart of the meditation, the absolute heart of mindfulness is recognizing that push-pull relationship we have with emotions and the feeling tone that arises as we're sitting. And the base of all of that is that compassion allows us. Compassion is the motivation. It's the motivation that says, I'm willing to sit with what's happening here and observe it and be part of it, be fully, completely connected to it. Sitting with is not a passive thing. I don't like using the term at all because it has all kinds of connotations of, you know, surrendering to it, which can be a dangerous process, and I never recommend that. For me, to sit in the presence of what's happening is what I mean by sit with something. To be willing to be present to it, to be willing to be a participant in it. So as you said, over the next couple of days, begin to attend to what's arising. You know, emotions may arise, they may not. Intense emotions may arise. Pay attention. What are the sensations? What are the early signals that these emotions were going, that they were approaching? What's the feeling tone? If you simply label the sensations, is it a different feeling tone than if you call it something? If I notice the sensations of you know, my heart rate, you know, discomfort in my belly area, you know, my breathing is a little bit more shallow. If I note it that way, does that different from saying, oh no, I'm starting to feel that anxious feeling again when I meditate? So notice what happens when you shift to the sensations as opposed to the emotional label. It's not to diminish the label, but it's to get under it. It's an interesting feature that we can very rarely, when someone's very upset and panic-stricken, we very rarely calm them down by just telling them to stop panicking. Calm down rarely works. In fact, it never works. Right? Because calm down comes in at the cognitive level. It comes in at the frontal lobe level. What's actually happening is at the sensation level. It's at the physiology level. So when we're experiencing upregulation, telling ourselves to stop it or to calm down doesn't work. But coming in underneath and soothing the sensation level has a better chance of hacking into the system. So Paul Gilbert has a lovely threefold model. He talks about the threat system, the resource-seeking system, and the soothing system. And you can read about that in many of his books, which are wonderful. What's really important when we think about meditation and mindfulness is to recognize that in many ways, we're making ourselves vulnerable to a threat system. Threat system says, you know, where's the saber-toothed tiger and how, when is it going to attack? And if I'm sitting still quietly with my eyes closed, my threat system is going to say, what are you doing? You can't see the saber-toothed tiger coming and you're likely to get eaten. Meditation postures are some of the most vulnerability-inducing postures you can imagine. You're in a room with people you don't know, you've got your eyes closed and you've got your back to some of them. Those of you in the front row, your threat systems are really activated, right? And particularly, you've got a history of unsafe environments. So one of the things that we always caution is Find places where you feel safe in a meditation process, in a meditation retreat, any of that. Don't be afraid to move around. In real life, though, us, you know, this is real life as well, but in our other real life, the threat system is what keeps us safe. That's why it triggers fight, flight, freeze, right? Our way of coping with it evolutionarily was to find resources that would protect us and to find soothing systems that would calm the physiology. So what we do in meditation is we're willing to open ourselves to experiencing that threat system. We're hoping and we're counting on the resources of safety in here, right, as facilitators, as the community. We're hoping to form that sense of safeness within the community. And then we're activating our soothing system through the meditation and the breath. So it's fascinating. It sort of occurred to me last night. This is the entire experimental laboratory for Gilbert's model. Right? The key of it, though, is that we have to learn how to activate that soothing system. And we do that with a compassionate approach as we sit. You know, if my knees are hurting, if my back is hurting, if I'm getting stiff and sore, I can change. I can lie down. I can sit on the floor. I can bolster myself with, you know, stuff under me. I can make sure that I feel safe, and that soothes me in terms of being able then to access the calming system. You can't access the calming system if you're in physical pain. So deal with that first. As we sit, the out-breath activates the vagal system. So which is why, you know, when we guide you, we say, taking a long, slow in-breath and letting the out-breath happen. Don't force it. Let it do its own work. The body knows how to soothe itself. We have to create the space where it can. That process of self-soothing is self-compassion. It's a way in which we turn towards ourselves with our very deep and profound compassionate mind that says, it's okay. I'm here with you. I'm not going anywhere. So that's the entire process of our meditation, if we're looking at it from a compassion perspective, with a compassion lens. It's that relentless, patient, kind turning towards ourselves over and over and over. Even though there's a part of us that says, yeah, no, I don't need it, I'm fine. No, no, it's cool, I'm good. I'm good to go. Right? And we go, yeah, of course you are. Let's just look at that again. That relentless turning back towards ourselves. Because it's almost impossible to be compassionate for the world if we can't come from a place of self-compassion. Because then we don't have any resources. We don't know what it means to feel soothed. We don't know what it means to feel safe, to feel joy, to feel an acceptance of things as they are. So maintaining our attention on compassion as a motivation, as the motivator for everything that we do. And looking at the emotions that we bring into the system. It can be anger, it can be frustration. Those things really activate a lot of social change. It can be love. It can be sadness. It can be joy. But mostly, I think it has to be because we know our own suffering and we would not wish that on anybody else. We know what it feels like. I don't think there's anyone in this room who hasn't hit rock bottom at some point or another in their lives. And we know that. We know what that feels like. And I'm willing to bet that you would never wish that on anybody, no matter what your feelings were for them. Once you got past the resentment and anger for people you don't like, you know, you really would not wish this on anybody, right? Recognizing we're human too. So it's because of that, it's because we would never wish this on anyone else, that we work to transform ourselves, to be compassionate with ourselves, so that we can be compassionate for others. So that we can sit in the presence of their suffering and not be derailed or absorbed into it or swept away. So that we're not trying to fix it so it doesn't upset us anymore. So that we can be honest about whether or not it's outside our capacity to be with it. I think sometimes the kindest thing that we could say to people that are stuck in their suffering is that they need more than what we can give. Because fundamentally, we're not the cause of their suffering. We're willing to walk with them as far as we can, but they have to walk their own path. So compassion demands an awful lot of us, as do our emotions, right? Compassion demands so much patience and courage and fearlessness. All of which comes back to our willingness to feel everything that we feel inside us so that we would not be knocked back by anything that comes up. So over the next meditation periods, I really encourage you to bring your attention to those sensations that are arising, to the emotion labels that you give to those sensations. Begin to connect with that moment of gone and notice the feeling tone. Is it pleasant or unpleasant? It's just a label. Martine Batchelor says the ending of an unpleasant moment is a pleasant moment. And the ending of a pleasant moment is an unpleasant moment. That, for me, is the other secret to the universe. Once I heard that, I thought, yep, I don't think I need to know anything more. Just notice that, right? Just noticing those moments when something is gone. So the impermanence piece is really important. I think that's all I have to say. Go forth and feel joyful. Or not. It's really up to you.